You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Before we begin, a content warning. This episode includes discussion of sexual abuse, spiritual abuse, and institutional negligence, including references to ongoing civil litigation involving Duluth Vineyard, Vineyard USA, Michael and Brenda Gatlin, and Jackson Gatlin. Listener discretion is advised. Throughout Spoiled Fruit, you've already heard select clips from Spencer Kluven, the Florida-based attorney representing multiple victims in this case. Spencer has spent years advocating for survivors of sexual abuse and systemic misconduct. His previous clients include victims in the Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Cosby cases, as well as other nationally significant matters involving powerful institutions. In this episode, I'm sharing our full conversation, because Spencer offers a perspective that's both legally precise and deeply human. We talk about the timeline of the Duluth case, the red flags that were ignored, and what he believes justice and accountability should look like, not just in the legal system, but inside the church. This is my full conversation with attorney Spencer Kluven. Okay, so thank you, first of all, for coming on the show today on behalf of the victims, obviously, in Duluth. Obviously, a horrible situation, but tell us a little bit first about, first introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your experience in handling cases like this, particularly involving institutional or church-related abuse, which obviously this is.
I appreciate it. And John, thank you for having me on today. So obviously, my name is Spencer Kluven. I'm a board-certified civil trial attorney. My home base is here in Palm Beach, Florida, but I litigate cases nationwide, and I have been specializing in sexual trauma, sexual abuse, and sex trafficking type cases for probably going on about 20 years now. I've handled all different types of cases involving abuse, and those cases range from things like inappropriate utilization of private videotapes, you know, secret videotaping of private incidents with two people where one is non-consenting, abuse like rape, abuse like physical abuse. And these can be individuals or institutions that I go against across the country. Cases that are representative of some of the work I've done involve the Jeffrey Epstein cases, where I represented 9 of those victims, and I represented victim number 1 back in 2008. She was the first victim to actually go to the police and report Mr. Epstein's conduct on Palm Beach Island, and it actually started that initial investigation back in the late 2000s. That then, obviously, as we all know now, kind of steamrolled into what it eventually became. But I've also represented other individual victims. For example, I represent Farrah Abraham, who is a teen mom. She was one of the originals on the MTV show, who was attacked here in Palm Beach by a man who has been accused of many different rapes out in California. And he was a former mayor, actually, in Northern California that had to step down from his position as a result of some of the allegations that were brought against him. I've also represented victims of Bill Cosby. Back when those incidents came out, I helped a bunch of those victims, one in particular, through the process, both the criminal and the civil process, in trying to help walk them through what is otherwise a very difficult proceeding to people that really don't understand the system, either criminal or civil.
Wow. So how did you become, tell people a little bit about how you became first involved in representing the victims from Duluth Vineyard.
So the victims from Duluth, unfortunately, were voluminous. And a couple of them were really excellent advocates on behalf of the victims. And they worked together as a group to try to vet and screen attorneys that could help them throughout the country. And thankfully, my name came up as one of those attorneys that works throughout the country on behalf of victims. And they sought me out and found me here in Palm Beach and asked if I could help.
So if you could, give us a high-level overview of the civil case and kind of explain for people out there the difference between a civil and a criminal case, and then kind of explain who the plaintiffs are, who the defendants are, and what is being alleged at this point.
Sure. So there are two separate tracks that cases like this go down. One is the criminal track, and the other is, as you mentioned, the civil track. There are two separate court systems in our country. Criminal courts deal with what's called proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you lose a criminal case as a defendant, you can go to jail. And the prosecutor in those cases is representing the state, in this case, the state of Minnesota. It is a very important distinction because victims, while they have a say and they're allowed to voice their opinion in the process, the prosecutor is not required to listen to what victims say. And they may prosecute cases that victims do not want prosecuted, and they may drop cases that victims want prosecuted because they are not representing the victims per se. They're representing the state of Minnesota on behalf of all citizens within that state to prosecute someone who they feel has broken the law. Now, the civil court system is very different. I represent the victims. I am their advocate. And I have one obligation, and that is to the victims themselves, not to the state, not to the system of justice. My sole obligation is to fight for and advocate for my clients who are the victims. So in that process, we gathered evidence, and this was before charges were even filed. We were able to marshal evidence together, make sure that all the girls were able to support each other on an emotional level. We were able to give interviews to the state attorney's office and their investigators through the process. And my office, in working with the victims at the time, we were able to make sure that the victims were heard by the state. And I was able to advocate for what the victims wanted, which was first and foremost to put their abuser behind bars. And that is what my clients, the victims, primarily wanted. Once that was accomplished, once we were able to get the plea deal done and he was put behind bars, then we moved to the second phase, which is a broader overview of what we felt was a failing of an entire system that allowed this incident to occur. And in a civil case, we have to prove by what's called the greater weight of the evidence. And I explain this to juries all the time throughout the country. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is very high, right? It is a very high bar to reach because you don't want to put someone in jail unless you are absolutely certain that they did that crime. In the civil justice system, it is very different because you're only dealing, frankly, with financial remuneration. And oftentimes, large corporations, large institutions, that's all they listen to is if it hits their bottom line. So proof in the civil justice system is by a greater weight of the evidence, which is just a tipping of the scale. As I explained to jurors, you know, if you have 50 pieces of paper here on one hand and 50 pieces of paper here on the other hand, if I take one piece of paper and move it from the right side to the left side, then the left side has satisfied their burden. Now, I believe that we have evidence of an institutional failure that is far beyond just a greater weight of the evidence, but is frankly at the level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that there was knowledge, that the institution knew what was going on and failed to prevent further abuse throughout time, which caused many additional victims to be abused by this perpetrator. Now, we are at the early stages of our case. The complaints have all been filed. They have all been responded to with general denials by the institutions as well as the individuals. And we are now in what we call the discovery phase of the case. And that phase will last for probably a year or so.
Yeah, you sort of answered my next question, which is, you know, what really stood out to you about Duluth Vineyard and Vineyard USA? Because we're really dealing with two different entities here, both the local church and also the sort of national structure at large, which is got to be sort of a unique situation for you. So explain kind of what you saw initially that kind of stood out to you, you know, when taking on this case.
So what we initially found was that the local chapter, so the Duluth chapter of the Vineyard Church, was run by someone who had a very large voice on the national level with the national organization. In fact, was being vetted to become ultimately, potentially, an executive director of the national organization, but at the very least, had a seat at the table with the national organization. And we believe that because of that and because of the relationship between the leader at Duluth and the fact that the abuser was his own child, that led to an unfortunate situation where there was absolutely no oversight that could have caught this behavior and stopped it. Because you have to ask yourself the question, had the abuser been someone other than his son, would he have done more? Would his mother, you know, both the mother and father, right? Both Gallons were leaders at the local church. And this was their son being accused of these heinous acts. No parent wants to think something like that of their own child. I understand that as a parent. But you have to also step aside and understand as a leader that if you are leading an institution, especially a religious institution, right, that you have to be above reproach, even if dealing with your own child. And that's where we believe the failures occurred. And it was the failures we believe in the policies. It was the failure in oversight by both the local and the national organization that led to this abuse over such a long period of time.
Yeah, you really kind of hit on my next question, which is, you know, one of the things in investigating and researching for this podcast series, a few things kind of stuck out, which is, you know, the role of things like nepotism and lack of reporting mechanisms and conflicts of interest. How do those things play into this case legally and ethically?
I think that all of those things that you mentioned are directly on point for why the failures in this particular case occurred. And those are the things and types of issues that we'll be asking the people on a national level, if it gets to that in depositions and the like, and discovery, as to why they allowed this to occur. Why would you ever allow a leader of a local institution to oversee any investigation or complaint from someone that's in his own family? Why would you allow that child to oversee other children? And then once you heard complaints, how could you possibly do an independent investigation of your own child? Right? So it's that complete lack of oversight that causes these types of failures. And you know, ultimately, institutions have to answer for that. Unfortunately, in our system of justice, if an institution doesn't police themselves, then it is our job as attorneys and advocates for victims to do that policing for them and to make them ultimately, you know, recognize those failures. And the only way to truly recognize those failures is, unfortunately, the only thing I can do is make them pay a financial remuneration that makes them recognize those failings.
Yeah. Talk about, and maybe there aren't any differences, but from a legal perspective, what are some of the challenges when pursuing legal action against a religious organization like Vineyard USA versus something that's a non-religious organization?
So for many years in, for example, Catholic Church litigation, where I think it's, you know, well documented over the past number of decades that there have been unfortunate abuses within the Catholic Church. I bring that up just to say that in a religious institution such as that, initially defenses were raised in those cases that the church should police themselves, that it should be held, the oversight and policing should be done within the organization, the religious organization, based on religious values, based on religious teachings. While I don't disagree that that should occur as well, right? I do disagree that that should be the only method by which victims can seek some type of justice. Because if you keep all of it within a religious institution, then what you're doing is, again, you're failing to have any independent objective oversight on what's occurring. So while one church may be fantastic in their oversight and may be great at what they're doing in rooting out any abuses or problems or issues and preventing them, another may not. So if you utilize this rule for both and for all, then you're going to have abuses of that system and you're going to have victims that have absolutely no ability for redress. And that's where you have catastrophic failures with systemic abuse over a long period of time. And that's, for example, like I said, what happened, unfortunately, in the Catholic Church is you had systemic abuses that lasted over decades of time because they were, quote, policing themselves. And as you see, even in the most storied historic religious institutions, they failed to be able to do that appropriately.
Yeah, absolutely. Often in these cases, the legal process forces institutions to disclose internal documents or communication, obviously, without asking for anything confidential. Can you speak to whether that's happened here and what patterns or concerns sort of emerged from that?
So while I can't disclose specific discovery, what I can say is that to its credit, Vineyard did open up two separate independent investigations that did get into their internal documents, processes, procedures, and went through and analyzed those in comparison to what had occurred in this case. And those two independent organizations that were retained by Vineyard found that they were failures, massive failures on the part of the national and the local churches. And they analyzed these circumstances based not just on what the victims were saying, but they interviewed people within the institution. They went through documents that the institution provided to them, communications, policies, bylaws, all of that, and found that these failures had occurred. One of the organizations that conducted that investigation was Grace, and that organization is Godly Response to Abuse within the church environment. So this was a religious investigation, essentially, that found that Vineyard, unfortunately, didn't hold up to what it had promised it would do.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Yeah, it's And it's interesting. I'm glad you pointed that out, because there were two internal investigations, one through Grace, one through another group called Guidepost. One was commissioned by Duluth, the local church, the other by Vineyard USA. There definitely seems to be a clear split on how Duluth Vineyard has responded versus how Vineyard USA has responded. Duluth, to their credit, has perhaps the most I don't know how to put it, but open and transparent. That's the word I'm looking for. Transparent process I've ever seen. If you go to their website, there's just documents upon documents posted, yeah, including internal conversations that I'm sure the participants didn't realize would end up in the public view. But how does that affect how you handle a case like this?
Whenever you have a circumstance with a local institution that is overseen by a national institution, right? It happens not only in religious organizations, but it happens in the context of hospitals, nursing homes. You have local, local facilities that are then overseen by national organizations or holding companies. And whenever those circumstances occur where something bad happens at the local institution, again, whether it be a church or a nursing home or a hospital, the national organization always responds, in 30 years I've been doing this, we had no idea. We had no clue what was happening, right? That is the standard response by the national organizations in cases where you have a local, circumstance and a national is overseeing. What we find often in cases like that is that despite their shock and dismay and feigned ignorance, that the reality is that they either ceded all of their oversight to the local organization, in which case they failed to do any oversight, or alternatively, they did oversee but chose to look the other way for one reason or another. Because in this case, you've got somebody that's high up in the national chain of the organization who's saying, these are all false, this is BS, people are lying, I'm correct and everyone else is wrong. And when you're talking to somebody who's sitting right next to you on the board, you're more likely to probably believe that person, right? So it's something that we're going to have to get into. But I have no doubt that the national organization is going to claim what every national organization always does in these circumstances is, we had no idea what was going on in Duluth. Well, that's a problem for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things, I'm just curious, from a legal perspective, if this comes into play, and if so, how it comes into play, can you speak to whether any steps taken by Vineyard USA, in particular, there are a couple of things that were kind of problematic. A, paying severance to the Gatlins, both Michael and Brenda. And the other one is allowing them to attend other Vineyard churches after the criminal investigation was made public. How does that factor in, if at all, to legal arguments about institutional responsibility?
So issue number one, I think, is very problematic, because if you're acknowledging that someone allowed this to occur within their parish, within their church, within their organization, then that is termination for cause. Termination for cause does not account for negligence, or it does not account, for severance. When you terminate someone for cause, they don't get severance, right? Alternatively, if you're saying, well, we don't know if you're right or you're wrong, but let's part ways, then I could understand a severance. But this was not that, it shouldn't have been that circumstance. So that I see as highly problematic for the national organization. That was a decision that should not have been made that way. The second issue of allowing them to attend Vineyard churches, I would never want to stop or dissuade anyone from seeking religious guidance. That is a personal choice that I support fully. And as long as they are banned from any leadership within any institution, then I think if they want to go and pray on Sunday and it happens to be a Vineyard church that they feel comfortable with the sermons at those types of churches, and albeit, let them be a parishioner, let them be someone who goes and prays of their own accord. So two separate issues, I think. One is problematic, one less so.
So if you're able to respond to this one, have your clients expressed frustration at how long it took for accountability to happen, even after the arrest and public reports? Because if you go back and look at some of the early sort of allegations and when they came about, we're talking well over a decade at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a huge problem for them. You know, there is evidence that was discussed in the criminal proceeding where one of the victims clearly made the church aware of what had occurred. And essentially, she was hit with denials and was, you know, kicked out and told to be quiet. And, you know, this type of behavior is so heinous and unbelievable that no one initially that hears it wants to believe it could be true. And I understand that. And then if it involves your own child, it's even worse, right? I mean, geometrically worse. But if you are a true religious leader, your obligation is to the members of not only your family, but your entire organization and church that you lead. And if you fail to lead them, or you lead them down a path where they end up getting abused, that is unbelievable to me. That is just awful. That is false guidance at its worst. At its worst. And the fact that this occurred over such a long period of time just shows you the lack of oversight by the national organization when it came to what was happening at the Duluth chapter.
So in the end, what would accountability look like to your clients, not just from obviously a legal outcome perspective, but also in terms of systemic change?
Well, let's talk about the change first, because that's, again, what is most important right now to my clients is that this will never happen again to another young girl in any of the chapters of Vineyard throughout the country or the world for that matter. They want certainty that there will be national change in policies and procedures and oversight for people who believe they're victims. That could include a anonymous 1-800 call line that is screened by an outside third party and evaluated. That could mean some type of oversight by an outside organization on a national level that reviews any of these issues and complaints within the churches throughout the world. That could mean the termination of certain individuals who may still be in an executive level position at this organization that were part of the systemic failures. You know, those types of people should lose their job. You know, if I as a lawyer am not doing my job for my employer, I should be fired. And similarly, I don't care how important or how high up you are in the organization, if you failed, and as a result, young children were sexually abused, you should lose your job. No questions asked. This is not about, you know, a failing financial issue with a church and a local organization, or, you know, various employees that weren't logging in correctly to their job. This is about, at its core, sexual molestation and abuse of children. And if you were leading the organization while that occurred under your watch, you should be fired. Now, second, unfortunately, the civil justice system can't do anything other than put a dollar amount on the harm that occurred. And that's ultimately what we have to determine. You know, what is a dollar amount that is fair to compensate the victims for what they went through? And it's the job of the attorneys on behalf of the organization to minimize that number And it is my job to advocate for a full measure of justice on behalf of the victims. And that's where the dispute really occurs in these types of cases. So what is fair? Ultimately, if we as the parties can't decide on a resolution ourselves, then it would be left up to a jury in Duluth to make that call.
So there's a good chance that there will be church leaders, board members, etc., listening to this podcast. And if they want to avoid repeating the failures identified in this case, what would you urge them to do right now?
Oversight. Oversight and believe victims. Children that come and talk about abuse, that are brave enough to be able to do that, believe them until something is proven otherwise. Believe them and make sure that the people that are guiding your children in all of these organizations are well-trained in spotting issues that could be problematic so that they can then train others within the organization to prevent this type of conduct. So an institutional training needs to occur. There needs to be an acknowledgement that whenever we gather as a community in groups, and especially when dealing with 20-year-olds and teenagers who potentially are sexually active, that these types of situations can occur, and you need to make sure that there are systems in place by the leadership to look out for it, to train people to look out for it, and to prevent it. You cannot just put your head in the sand and say, it's not happening here, or it'll never happen here. Because I'm here to tell you, it can happen there, and it can happen anywhere. In the best neighborhoods, in the smallest towns, and in the largest cities, by people that usually are the closest ones to you. National statistics show that 1 out of every 4 women, 1 out of every 4 have experienced some type of sexual abuse or sexual assault. If you are standing in a room with 4 women, odds are that at least one of them has a story that she either can tell or would rather not tell. Now, that ranges from everything from date rape to inappropriate touching to full-on potential rape by a third party. It includes and encompasses everything. But the church has to acknowledge that these types of things can occur and does occur within its own institution. And if you can stop it at its inception, then you prevent abuse of many others, many others.
Absolutely. That's a sobering statistic. So in light of that, what can people do to support survivors, whether in this case or in similar situations in their own communities?
Listen. Listen to what they have to say and let them speak their truth about what occurred to them and give them a measure of control, because that's what an abuse survivor loses in circumstances where they've been abused. They have lost control in that circumstance. They've lost control of their body. They've lost control of their story. They've lost control of their feelings. So listen to them. Let them speak. Let them talk about what happened, because that's how they heal, is through being able to experience this and retell it and have people talk to them about it and talk them through it. Don't judge them. Don't harshly question them. Listen. Listen to what they have to say. And certainly don't blame them. Right? One of the things that I've studied through doing this type of work, there was an author. In fact, I have a book here. There was a gentleman by the name of William Ryan who coined the phrase back in the 1970s, blaming the victim. And he actually wrote a book. Yeah, I just bought it the other day and I'm reading through it. And unfortunately, what happens in our society is that when an abuse survivor comes forward, the first thing is, well, where were you walking when that happened? What were you wearing when that happened? And how did you respond when he did this or that? Society needs to stop focusing on what the victim did or did not do and focus on what the abuser did. That's the focus. And frankly, that's my job as an advocate on behalf of victims. That's what I focus on. My entire case has everything to do with the abuser and the systemic abuse that may have occurred that allowed this to happen. Stop blaming the victims and start blaming the abusers. And then maybe things will change.
Last question. And again, really appreciate your time today. This has been very insightful. So is there anything that you want the public to understand about this case that hasn't been covered in the headlines?
I think a lot has already been covered. But I think the thing I would want most is for the institution to recognize where it may have not lived up to its goals and to care for the victims in a way that acknowledges that lack of recognition and acknowledges the failures that occurred so that the victims can be taken care of in a way and can look at the recovery and say, you know, this was fair and acknowledges their failures. And look, like I said at the beginning, unfortunately, this system that I'm a part of, the civil justice system, the only measure of justice in this system is financial remuneration, and it pays for damages. It pays for damages for medical bills, treatment, therapy, psychological care into the future and in the past. But most significantly, it pays for what's called mental pain and suffering and trauma. That is it's a nebulous concept, but it is a real concept. And the way I generally explain it to juries is, you know, if your loved one, if you're sitting at home and you get a call, and John, I don't know if you're married or not, but let's say your girlfriend or if you were married, your wife, right, calls you and says, honey, I was just in a crash. I'm at the hospital. Your first question to her is not going to be, how much are the doctor bills? The first question you're going to ask, are you okay? How do you feel? Right? Because that, as a society, is what we value most, is what that person has been put through on an emotional and traumatic level that will affect them for the rest of their lives. So the value of that needs to match the value of what was caused by what failures we believe occurred. And that's what I think gets forgotten a lot, is the value of just that, that emotional pain, trauma, and suffering that victims go through.
Thank you so much for coming on. I don't envy the job that you do and the stories that you have to hear in order to effectively do your job. It's certainly not for everyone, but thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of this with us, and just really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
The views and statements shared in this episode reflect the personal experiences and legal perspectives of those interviewed and do not necessarily represent the official position of any organization, past or present. This podcast is intended for educational and storytelling purposes only and should not be interpreted as legal, therapeutic, or professional advice. If you or someone you know has experienced abuse in a religious or institutional setting, we encourage you to seek help from qualified professionals and survivor-centered resources. Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power is written and hosted by me, John Williamson, and is a production of John Williamson Productions, LLC. Thanks for listening.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.